the decline in medicines access and the decline in investment has actually been going on for a decade. Now, quite clearly, this year, some of the policies of President Trump have rightly, I think, brought some of these issues into very sharp relief. But they're not as a result of those policies. I think these are decisions that have been made in the interests of the UK for the UK.
Great. OK, Richard Torbett, Chief Executive of the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry. Thank you very much for your time. Your message is still coming in on the Jeevan Sander interview as well. Thank you very much for those. Had some great chat from you throughout this show. That's it from me for this afternoon on The Times at One. My producer today was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. I thank them both. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. But up next on Times Radio, it's Fee Glover and Roy Anika. Do please stay with them here.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio.
Coming up on the programme today, new statistics reveal the crisis in NHS urgent care. We'll hear from the head of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine. The Justice Secretary is scrapping the right to be tried by a jury of one's peers. We know this, and we'll discuss that with the criminal barrister and star of the jury, Alex McBride. Our big interview after 3:30 is with Professor Chris Van Tulleken on his new live show. And what world record do you think you could break as some dodgeball players enter the Hall of Fame after a 48-hour match? Why? We're going to hear from the Guinness Book of World Records.
First, the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Roy. Good afternoon. And investigations found 12 police officers would have faced gross misconduct cases over the 1989 Hillsborough disaster had they still been serving. They include the match commander David Duckenfield and South Yorkshire Police's then Chief Constable Peter Wright. The Independent Office for Police Conduct has been looking into the handling of the crush at the Sheffield Stadium in which 97 Liverpool fans lost their lives. Louise Brooks's brother, Andrew, was one of them.
There'll be another cover-up. There'll be, you know, another disaster. And I think until things change at the very top, and I include MPs, I include chief constables, you know, nothing will ever change.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has called the Hillsborough disaster a stain on our nation's history. South Yorkshire Police says it's deeply sorry for the pain and heartache caused. And inquiries found sexually motivated crimes against women in public are not afforded the same response as other high-priority offences. The review was ordered following the murder of Sarah Everard by an off-duty police officer in 2021. The report chair, Lady Elish Angelini, warned of critical gaps in the prevention of violence against women and called for urgent action. Zoe Billingham's a former chief inspector of police forces.
Not sufficient progress has been made. Women still can't be safe. The burden of keeping them safe is still being pushed onto women themselves. And there now needs to be a relentless focus on the men that cause the harm, the perpetrators and the predators.
Speaking in the Commons in the past few minutes, the safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, has called the situation a national emergency. The Justice Secretary has been updating MPs about his plans to tackle the backlog of court cases in England and Wales.
I will create new swift courts within the Crown Court with a judge alone deciding verdicts in triable either way cases with a likely sentence of 3 years or less.
David Lammy also wants to give magistrates power to hand down longer sentences of up to 18 months. He says the entire process is on the brink of collapse, with 78,000 cases waiting to be heard and trials listed as far ahead as 2030. The former Director of Public Prosecution, Sir David Calvert-Smith, told Times Radio the reforms wouldn't be necessary if the court system was properly funded.
My worry is that every time we meet a problem like this, the cry goes up, well, let's get rid of juries, that'll make it all quicker. Of course it will, but it simply removes what seems to me as a citizen of this country to be one of its crowning glory, is that ordinary people do take part in trial of serious criminal cases. If the money's not there and it's not going to be provided, then something else will have to be done. I quite understand that.
A new international report says tax hikes and spending cuts will put pressure on the UK economy, with inflation remaining amongst the highest in the G7. The Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development says the government's fiscal plans are a headwind to growth. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has highlighted the OECD's forecast for growth is up and inflation is down, which she claims is a result of her budget. And Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff has landed in Moscow ahead of talks with Jared Kushner and Vladimir Putin on the draft Ukraine peace plan. Meanwhile, Volodymyr Zelensky is in Dublin. He says Kiev is committed to constructive cooperation with President Trump's team, but warned that Russia was using talks as a way to weaken sanctions. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, thank you to James and thank you to Jeremy as well. He had a tetchy interviewee there, didn't he? Did extremely well. And all of your messages are saying exactly the same thing. It's Fee Glover and Roy Nika with you. Welcome to Tuesday afternoon. Off we go again on our afternoon ship. Come with us if you can. We don't quite know the route we'll take, but we definitely dock at 4. We will make time today to have a chat about Roy's day job, which is, full title please.
I am Royal Editor for the Sunday Times.
And there's so much royal news to talk about always, but particularly at the moment. So would you mind if our punters this afternoon maybe popped you the odd question too? 0333 003 2353. There's nothing that Roy doesn't know. We all have press releases and stuff like that scattered across our desks in the production office, and I'm not the only member of the team to have noticed today that your press releases come with this extraordinary red-headed notepaper, a super stamp and a seal on them.
Yes, very they smart, do. Regal they? Press releases.
Yeah.
Embargoed.
Okay. Right.
What news?
Yeah, I didn't look at them. Honestly, I didn't. I did. In our running order for the next 2 hours, we will start with a look at a perennial story at this time of year. It doesn't make it any easier to digest, though, and that is waiting times in emergency departments in the NHS. We're also going to head abroad today to Sri Lanka in this hour of the programme to talk about the devastating floods there. And the jury is out, literally, we know that, and there will be more from the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, as we progress through the afternoon. He has stood up in the House of Commons to tell us exactly what the plan is, and there are very few voices in the legal profession who back this change to limit jury trials to the most serious of cases. And we'll discuss the future of our justice system with Alex McBride, criminal barrister and expert on Channel 4's The Jury. Now, after 3:30 today, our big interview is with Chris Van Tulleken, a campaigning voice against ultra-processed foods. He's also on to talk about his rather fabulous show for kids, Operation Ouch. It is on at the Royal Festival Hall over the Christmas season, and the subtitle of the show is The Quest for the Jurassic Fart. In about 20 minutes' time, we do have some light relief for you as well. We're going to talk about the weirdest world records that have been set this year. How big can any onion get? We're about to find out. What world record do you think that you could set or break, Ryanika?
I'm quietly confident I could have a decent crack at setting the world record for number of Cadbury's chocolate biscuit fingers consumed in a minute.
Okay, how many do you think you could do? Because that is bound to be in the Guinness Book of Records, isn't it?
I reckon I could get through a few boxes.
Oh my goodness, okay. If any of you out there have records that you have set or that you would like to break, it's the same number. We're 0333 003 2353. Just a little something to entertain us, be our twinkly lights of Christmas as we head through the afternoon. The most read stories on the Times website so far today, in at number 3, trans abuser who assaulted 13-year-old claims jury was hypnotised. Natalie Wolfe, 47, had been held on remand in Durham Prison, a men's prison, before being sentenced to 3 years. The second most read story, families face £3 million inheritance tax bills on failed gifts. The seven-year gifting rule has landed more than 14,000 people with hefty charges. And the most read piece on the Times website this afternoon is Robin Smith, England batting great dies, age 62. The South African-born cricketer was renowned for his ability against pace bowling. He had spoken openly about his battle with depression and alcoholism and addressed England Lions players only last week. His last interview was with Simon Wilde of The Times at the weekend, and you can hear Hugo Rifkin talking to Simon about that interview. If you want to, you can use the catch-up tool on the Times radio app. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need a digital subscription. If you don't have one, it is time to get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Between January and October this year, 452,595 people waited more than 12 hours for a bed in A&E following the decision to admit them into hospital. It's a record number, up 34,000 on the same period last year, and up from only 1,590 in 2016. The data was obtained by the Lib Democrats, who are calling for 1,000 extra hospital beds this winter and a recruitment drive to bring in more out-of-hours GPs. The new announcement of a five-day strike by resident doctors, which starts on December the 17th, is expected to worsen the situation. Well, a little earlier, I spoke to Dr. Ian Higginson, president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, and I asked him for his reaction to the statistics.
Well, sadly, we're not surprised at the Royal College of Emergency Medicine because these statistics reflect what's been going on for many years in our emergency departments. But that doesn't mean that we're not disappointed, because we have to live and breathe this every day, as do our patients.
And what is the actual reality on the ground in A&E when patients are coming in? What are they facing?
So the reality in the vast majority of emergency departments at the moment is there aren't enough beds in our hospitals. And what that means when you come to our emergency departments, if you need to be admitted, you're often ending up waiting in our corridors or in other inappropriate spaces while those beds become available. And that's a miserable experience for patients. And it's also a miserable experience for staff who are looking after those patients.
I mean, that is something that is not new. What is the reason why things have got so much worse, do you think? The escalation in terms of those figures is extraordinary. What has prompted such an enormous rise?
Well, the reason this has got worse is that there's been an abject failure, both amongst politicians and amongst health service leaders, to address this problem head on. The problem is that there aren't enough beds in our hospitals. And until we put that right, either through increasing the number of beds or through improving the way that social care is able to respond to the needs of patients when they're ready to leave, the problem is going to keep on getting worse and worse and worse. At the moment, although politicians are playing lip service to finding the solutions to this, they're not actually doing what's needed to sort this out.
I mean, we are in winter now. Is that going to make things worse? Will we see these figures get even worse as we go into winter?
Yes, things are likely to get worse, but it's important to point out that even across the summer months now, things are pretty dreadful in most emergency departments. It does get worse over winter. We all know that winter illnesses will hit and that people will get more respiratory infections in particular. But it's pretty rotten the whole year round now, and winter is just a worse version of that.
Without wanting to scaremonger our listeners off the back of these figures, in your opinion, will this, unless there is sort of radical action soon, will this cost lives?
This is already costing lives, and it has been for a number of years. And again, that's what's really disappointing to us at the Royal College. To our members and also to our patients. We know that long waits in emergency departments are associated with excess deaths. Something like one in every 72 patients who waits for more than 12 hours in our departments will die unnecessarily associated with that wait. So yes, patients are coming to harm, and that's why we are upset that it continues and angry that the right solutions aren't being put in place.
I mean, there is obviously the patient experience, which thousands of patients across the country are obviously facing horrendous conditions when they come into A&E. But there is also the experience of your members. What's it like for them working these conditions with these huge waiting lists and the extraordinary scenes in A&E when people are coming in and finding themselves in beds and seats where they shouldn't be?
It's pretty miserable to work at times in emergency departments, both for our members, who are predominantly doctors, but also for the nurses and the other members of our teams. We know we can do a really good job for our patients if we're given the tools to do that, but we can't do it in corridors. And again, our voice seems to have been lost in this, whilst our politicians and health service leaders are focusing on other problems.
I mean, in your opinion, what are the sort of simple answers that government could start with? It's not just about the money, is it? Because successive governments have pledged more money to the NHS and this problem's only got worse. What would be the first simple steps to take? You talk about providing more beds, but I mean, what are the logistics on the ground in terms of doing this?
There are no simple steps to take, and it is about money, but that money has to be spent in the right places. At the moment, we're focusing on the wrong things. What we need to focus on are the number of beds in our hospitals and the staff to man those beds. We need to get our hospitals working effectively across the week, not just during the working week. And also we need to make things right so that patients who are ready to be discharged from hospital can leave hospital when they're fit to do so. And those three things are what is needed to cure this crisis.
Can I just get an idea from you in terms of you mentioned that, you know, a lot of money is being spent in the wrong places. What would be an example of that?
Well, we're spending an awful lot of money trying to manage the patients who are coming into our hospitals and find different ways of treating those, rather than spending that money instead, or an equal amount of money, on patients who are ready to leave our departments. So at the moment, we're focusing on the front door of our hospitals, but we're ignoring the back door of our hospitals, and it's the back door that's causing the problems in emergency departments today.
Resident doctors have said they're going to strike from the 17th of December. That is clearly going to make things a lot worse, isn't it?
I'm not going to discuss the strikes. It's not something that, as a Royal College, we get involved in. We fully respect the right of resident doctors to take industrial action should they choose to do so. And beyond that, the Royal College tends not to get involved in industrial action discussions.
So presumably you don't have a view on Wes Streeting saying that if the strike goes ahead, the BMA would have turned doctors into the Grinch who stole Christmas?
I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay. Can I ask, Ian, the reality is we have the situation on the ground. We also have an ageing population. Is this an issue that is actually fixable with more money and with changing logistics and with changing procedures on the ground? Or realistically, with an ageing population, is it something that's going to be very, very, very difficult to tackle and solve? Is it fixable is what I'm asking?
This is absolutely fixable. It just requires the determination to fix it. It requires the focus to be on the right things, and it needs proper strategic planning and political will. But yes, it's absolutely fixable. And again, that's what is so disappointing.
In your opinion, Ian, has this been sort of a failure of successive governments? That's what it feels like you're saying. And if that's the case, why do you think governments keep getting it so wrong when the NHS seems to be something that is an absolute priority for most voters?
There has been a failure of successive governments, despite the fact that the NHS is a priority for most voters. That is because the problems in emergency departments and the solutions are often seen as being in the too hard basket, and they also take a long time to put into place. So it's not something you can suddenly do and then sell to voters as an instant fix. I'm afraid politicians are often looking for quick fixes rather than the right fixes. And that's one of the problems we face in tackling this problem.
When the Department for Health or Wes Streeting or previous ministers and secretaries of state have approached this issue, have they reached out to you for your input? Do they reach out to your members for input in terms of what are the solutions going forwards and the best way to implement them?
I think it's fair to say that over the years we've had variable engagement from senior politicians, including ministers of state for health and social care. At times. So yes, we are occasionally reached out to, but we've offered lots of evidence on this, lots of advice as to what seems to have been done. And sadly, that hasn't been put into place.
In terms of, you know, the reality on the ground, you mentioned it's very difficult for both patients and a lot of your members, the working conditions. Do we have any sort of idea from these figures or your own experience of your members in terms of location and geographically, is this worse in certain parts of the country? Is there a postcode lottery in terms of A&E treatment?
No, it's equally bad across the country and sadly across the four nations of the UK. So we know that this problem is experienced by patients in almost every single hospital. And the consequences of it are dealt with by staff in almost every single hospital across the UK.
if Wes Treating was to turn around and suddenly say, you know, Ian, give me the three top points of things you would like to see implemented immediately, what would those three things, the sort of critical three things be in terms of addressing this issue, this crisis even?
Give the back door of emergency departments the same focus as is currently being afforded to the front door. We need more staffed beds in hospitals. We need hospitals to work effectively across the working week. And we need patients who are medically fit to be discharged from hospital to be enabled to go home.
Finally, can I just ask, Ian, is there one bit of advice you would give to patients coming in? And what I mean is, there has historically been an issue of people sometimes coming into A&E when perhaps they should go and see their GP or it's not critical. Are there any sort of advice you would give to patients before coming into A&E, given the situation on the ground, what they're likely to expect?
This problem really isn't the result of patients coming to emergency departments who could be treated elsewhere. The patients who are waiting for beds need to be in hospital. That's the whole point. So what I'd say to patients is we have to tell it how it is. We have to tell how bad things are in emergency departments. But at the same time, we are still open and we will still do our best to look after you if you choose to use our services or if you come to our services because you have no other choice.
And that takes us to 20 minutes past two. If you have your own experiences of being in accident and emergency, waiting times, etc., at this time of year, we would love to hear from you this afternoon. VJs in militant mood, we should do with these doctors what they did in Korea. Fire the lot of them. Get them to apply for a job on NHS terms. It'll hurt, but we'll be rid of a militant union. We have a country full of managers who don't manage and are frightened of their own shadow. This includes the Prime Minister. In an eternal what-if doom cycle. Coming up, 48 hours of dodgeball, growing the biggest onion on earth. What world record do you think you could set? You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Nika on Times Radio. We're with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Local, national, global, there's always an election and politicians are always thinking about the next one.
The smell of victory is the thing that actually makes it worthwhile.
On How to Win an Election, we've assembled a crack team of strategists who've all been at the top political table for both the good times and the terribly bad.
In the end, that is what a Prime Minister does.
Every week, we answer the big political questions.
Are we living in Morgan McSweeney's government or Keir Starmer's?
Listen to How to Win an Election wherever you get your podcasts.
Best episode yet.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms. The free bathroom design service includes a home visit. So when you're ready to plan your new bathroom, let the Wix experts measure up for you. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Steve has got a completely different experience of the A&E department at the Royal London Hospital at Whitechapel, where he says the turnaround time is excellent, typically in and out within 6 hours, and the major part of that delay is a blood test. How come they can get it right and, according to your speaker, the rest can't? And it's so true, isn't it, Steve? There are just so many different experiences across the country, depending on the hospital, depending on the month, and sometimes depending on the time of day. And, of course, it just seems absurd that that should be the case in what is a remarkably small country by comparison to others. We always appreciate your experiences. They certainly inform the questions that we put to our interviewers. So if you want to be in touch and you've got something longer to say, actually it's janeandfee@times.radio if it is easier to use the email. Now, we've had some news just in from the Public Accounts Committee, which is hugely relevant to Rwanika. And we will talk about this a little bit more in the next half an hour of the programme. But the top line of this is something that could cause quite a lot of bother for the royal family.
I don't think it'll make very happy reading at Buckingham Palace, because the Public Accounts Committee has just put out a release saying it is going to be launching an inquiry called the Crown Estate, which is based on correspondence between the PAC and the Crown Estate about the lease arrangements for Royal Lodge. Now, that's something that, you know, writers across the Times have done a lot of work on. It's not been easy to get that information out of it. And I think they've clearly not been happy with what they found so far in that correspondence. So an inquiry will follow next year.
So does an inquiry mean that they will be able to compel correspondence and evidence to be made public, exactly the type of thing that hasn't been available before?
They are going to, after they publish the inquiry report in June, they're going to have an evidence session. They will call witnesses. Given that it's about Royal Lodge, I think you can safely assume that they will try and call Prince Andrew, the former Prince Andrew, Andrew Breton Windsor, to that session, to ask him questions about how that lease arrangement came about.
Right, well, that would be extraordinary to see, wouldn't it? More on that. We are going to make time in the next half an hour of the programme to talk about all of the royal news as we have Roya with us today. We are going to have a little bit of light relief for the next couple of minutes or so. It's time for our dive into the weird and wonderful universe of world records, where humans and the occasional animal push the limits of whatever they can think of, really. We're talking most snails on a face. Why would you? Biggest onion ever grown, tallest dog to ever tower over its owner, and even awards for the world's stretchiest skin. This week, a group of 24 people played dodgeball for 48 hours in England to raise money and set a brand new record for the world's longest dodgeball game. Let's talk to Craig Glenday, editor-in-chief at Guinness World Records. Craig, a very good afternoon from us.
Hi, thank you.
Is there something that all of these people have in common who want to set or break a record, or is it genuinely just more random?
I think there's an innate human need for validation, and if you're doing things which maybe most people don't understand or, you know, don't get, then we're here to sort of say we're a very open, very broad church. We're interested in all things fun and, you know, engaging and inspiring and impressive, you know. And if no one else will say anything to you, we'll say yes if we like the idea. On saying that, we say no, I have to say, to about 95% of what we get. So if you think what you see now is strange, you should see what we have to process.
OK, well, I really do want to hear more about what you have to process. What do you think is the strangest thing that you've had to turn down?
Oh, I mean, there's so many. I mean, some of my favourites have been like dog with the fewest legs. There's a guy that had a dog with three legs and he thought that might have been record worthy. Of course, we wouldn't accept that because, well, for two reasons. Once you have no legs, you can't beat the record, and that's one of the criteria. Because the records must be beatable. And also, we don't want to encourage people to be taking the legs off their dogs or any animals.
Oh, my goodness, Craig. You know, this conversation has taken such a strange turn. Let's talk a little bit about the more positive things then. This dodgeball game for 48 hours, I know it was in the name of charity, but how does a dodgeball team kind of decide? I mean, was there somebody who played a game for 47 and a half hours, so they thought, OK, we'll go for 48?
Well, in fact, yes, 41 hours. So that was the existing record, which was from Vermont in the USA. And, you know, that's the end. That's the latest point in the history of this record where people have just played for longer and longer. We've got some of our sporting marathons go on for days. We've got like a 5-day. I'm sure baseball is, I think basketball and baseball are both about 5 days of playing. So It's a very big, interesting category for us that a lot of people around the world are interested in doing. So it's, you know, we don't make the records up. We hear from the public and they tell us what they want. And if enough people are interested in the topic, then we think, well, okay, as long as it satisfies our criteria, then we'll accept it. And, you know, it's fun, it's healthy, it gets you playing. team spirit and all that team building. It's good for you. So yeah. Why not, really?
Did these people stay awake for 48 hours? Did the whole team have to play for 2 days?
We have specific guidelines for different records, but for something like a marathon, you are allowed to accrue breaks. And in certain team records, you can swap the team members in and out throughout the process. So you're not fully awake, because otherwise these things just turn into how long can you stay awake?
Yeah.
And then you start to lose the quality. So they have to actually be playing the game, which is why we insist on things like video evidence, independent witness statements to say they're actually playing. You know, I've watched someone play the piano for 2 days, and at the end of it, he was just barely making the odd note every few seconds and had to be disqualified, sadly, because, you know, that's not really playing the piano. I mean, that's just you've just sat at the piano and pressed some notes. Whereas this, you know, we have to demonstrate that you are doing the thing that you claim to be doing. So, yes.
Then, Craig, how did you get into this line of work?
My background is in publishing, so I've worked on developing lots of magazines and books over the years, so I know very, very little about an awful lot of things. So my knowledge base is very wide but very shallow, and this is the perfect job for me, you know, because my attention span goes like that, you know. And but here I have something interesting every day. There's so many inspiring things happening around the world. And people are enjoying that time between, you know, birth and death and just having fun. And we get to see a very different shade of news coverage because it's not all grim. You know, yeah. Most people are actually quite enjoying life.
Absolutely. And people do want to try and enjoy a bit of life. Do you happen to know how heavy or how large the biggest onion ever grown was?
Well, I know it was. I've measured one myself. I measured one by Peter Glazebrook. Which I think, though, he has now had it beaten just this year. But we're talking, you know, it's bigger than my head, and I've got a big head.
I can see you on Zoom, Craig. I don't want to say anything about the size of your head. It looks perfectly normal to me. Most snails on a face was another one that I mentioned there, and you've just got to think, why? I mean, why does anyone have a lot of snails on their face anyway?
Yes, I think that's now a category that we no longer monitor because we were slightly concerned about the snail's well-being. But yes, it was a record category. Oh, no, I say that. Yes, it's now I'm looking at my notes. It's inactive. Okay. We got to 48 snails and then had to call it a day.
Right. I'm loving this. You've also given us an exclusive about Ozzy, a four-year-old French Mastiff dog. Now, what record has Ozzy managed to set?
Oh, is this our tall dog?
No, this is the dog. So we got the tall dog. I don't know what the tall dog was called, but he came in at 44 inches tall, didn't he? But I think this one has got a very, very long tongue.
Oh, okay. We told you that one. Okay, that's good. I thought that we were keeping that one. Okay.
No, fine. I think as long as we don't show anybody the photograph, I thought we were allowed to mention it. Have we broken an embargo? Okay, am I about to be taken off air? Gosh, this is terrible. This could be the end of my career. I'm going to be cancelled, Craig, over a bull mastiff with a very long dog and long tongue. I mean, what?
It is a category that we do monitor. We do like dogs with long tongues. And we've had it for about at least 10 years now. I'm just going to check. I've got my notes. Longest dog tongue. Like, for example, we've had about over 100 applications for this in the last 6 years.
Right. I can actually tell you, because I've got your press release in front of me here, and it says that Ozzy has got the longest tongue on a living dog. It measures 7.83 inches. And for those people who are operating in the centimetre world, that's 19.89 centimetres. It's a very, very, very long tongue indeed.
Relatively, actually, in dog tongue terms, I mean, whilst that's the current record, I know the longest ever we've measured is 43, but that's obviously a dog quite a few years ago now. But So 19 is relatively short, although it's quite a when you think about it, I suppose. Yeah. But yes.
Okay, this has just become incredibly bizarre, Craig, but it has been lovely. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you, yes.
Craig Glenday is the editor-in-chief at Guinness World Records.
Sri Lanka has been hit by the worst natural disaster in decades,
We'll hear from a journalist in the country's capital. But first, it's the news with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Roy. Good afternoon. In the past half hour, the Commons Public Accounts Committee has announced it's to launch an inquiry into the Crown Estate. It follows questions over the organisation's lease of Royal Lodge to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And investigations found 12 police officers would have been disciplined for gross misconduct over the Hillsborough disaster had they still been serving. It's after the Independent Office for Police Conduct examined the police's handling of the 1989 tragedy in which 97 people died. An inquiry into the murder of Sarah Everards found sex offences against women are not given the same response as other high-priority crimes. Its report finds violence prevention schemes are often just words. Kate Chadwick's from the charity Tomorrow's Women, which offers support in Cheshire and Merseyside.
I would say every woman has some type of experience. You do find that men will be surprised when you tell them we don't feel safe.
The Justice Secretary, David Lammy's, announced juries will be scrapped in England and Wales for defendants facing a sentence of 3 years or less. Magistrates will also be handed more powers to help reduce court backlogs. And the former England cricketer, Robin Smith, has died at the age of 62. He scored more than 4,000 test runs and held the record for the national team's highest ever one-day international score. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford is doing very well this afternoon with our listeners. AJ wants to report this doesn't work for everybody and in all circumstances, but I've been to A&E at the John Radcliffe in Oxford at 6 a.m, waiting overnight after a sports injury. There are no queues at this time. I love Times Radio. Kate says my GP practice in Tame in Oxfordshire is brilliant, as is the John Radcliffe, in my experience, with excellent care also at the Churchill Hospital. Big shout out. And Dominic, you're absolutely right. It would be a first if somebody got banned for showing a photograph on the radio, but we're ever so visual these days. We've got the Instagram, we've got the YouTube, we've got all kind of clips to show, but I know what you mean. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hello, Fee.
Where will you start?
With juries. So, I mean, as we've been discussing, so the right to a jury trial goes back before Magna Carta in the early 13th century, well before that. And I'm sure an awful lot of people don't care about jury trial and the right to jury trial. Maybe they're just perfectly law-abiding people, think it'll never really touch their lives, and maybe with hardened criminals may feel they don't really care much about it either. But I'm going to be discussing why perhaps it does matter and why perhaps people should care, and what is being lost in the changes that we've heard about today. So I'm going to be talking to Sir Brian Leveson, the former senior High Court judge, who put in a report calling for change. What does he think? I've got the Courts Minister, Sarah Sackman, and a former DPP, Max Hill. Also looking at the Russia talks in Moscow, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner out there, you know, for Donald Trump. Is there a point? Is this going anywhere? Or is it just more of the same old grim merry-go-round? So try and get a take and some expert thoughts on that. And I'm going to be looking at cigar lounges. The, I don't know if you saw the story. The,
I did. I found it hard to feel sympathy for the demise of this
couple. That's interesting. And why do you think that?
Well, I just think, I mean, I was a dedicated smoker for longer than I've not been a smoker. So maybe it's hypocritical to say, now we know about smoking and the damage and the dangers of it, why are we tolerating any form of it?
Right. Well, so the argument from the cigar side is that they're tasting cigars. You don't smoke cigars necessarily in the same way as cigarettes. But your reaction is interesting. One of our team out there on the show was very against cigar lounges. It seemed to me because she didn't like the idea of posh men smoking cigars. It seemed a little bit of a maybe slightly prejudiced view of this thing. But did you know, because I didn't, that the Ritz's cigar lounge can sell you a cigar for £1,000? For one smoke of a cigar.
Yes.
Maybe that's not guaranteed to whip up sympathy and support for cigar smokers.
They're just tasting lounges. That's what they're trying to say. So you don't actually smoke. You just go in there and roll it around between your finger and thumb.
You can smoke them in there.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I say this not through experience.
Yep.
But it's not just sucking them.
Okay. I just think they're disgusting, so I'm sorry about that. So I'm not going to have my mind changed.
Yeah, well, you come back and talk about cigars with me.
Okay, well, that's an offer I've never had before, John. I may never have again. Thank you very much. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
What an offer, Fee. Now, more than 400 people have died in floods and mudslides in Sri Lanka. Cyclone Ditwa is the worst natural disaster to hit the island in decades. Cyclones and monsoon rains have also killed hundreds in Indonesia, Thailand and Malaysia. Tina Edward Gunawardana is a journalist and senior writer at Sri Lanka's Daily Mirror newspaper, and she joins me now from Colombo. Tina, you're in Sri Lanka's capital. Hi, thank you so much for joining us today. What's the situation on the ground there now?
So I'm in Colombo, and my suburb is not too badly affected, but the other areas close by, because of the floodwaters, a lot of homes have been damaged, people have lost their livelihoods. But in the central areas of Sri Lanka and the northeast coast, northeast areas, they have been severely affected because of landslides and floodwaters. And I think if I read correctly, over 1 million people have been affected in some form or another.
And Tina, can I ask, first of all, have you had any friends or family who've been affected by the floods?
Yes, even my own colleagues who work in the newspaper office with us, some of them have had their houses flooded and their vehicles have been caught to the floodwaters. So yes, quite a lot of people who we know, and not only in the areas surrounding Colombo, but outstation as well. Like, for example, people who work in homes, their families who live in the villages, they too have been victims of this terrible, terrible natural catastrophe.
And from what you're reporting on the Sri Lanka Daily Mirror, what's your understanding of this current situation on the ground in Sri Lanka?
So the government agencies are doing their best to address the issues that have arisen. But more than that, what I have noticed is in this time of calamity, the people have got together, the resilience they have shown, the community spirit. I mean, they've put aside ethnic differences, religious differences. Everybody has banded together. Even in my own suburb today, one of the tuk-tuk drivers, he called me and he said, "Miss, we are cooking food for the displaced. Can you give a donation? This is what we need." So everybody, whatever way they can, they are all banding together to help one another, which I think it's a remarkable thing. And I'm so very proud of our people for that.
That is really...
And not only in Sri Lanka, even the diaspora overseas, they are coming together as well to support us.
That's really heartening, Tina. Can I ask, are you surprised by that response? I mean, I've been to Sri Lanka and it's an amazing, extraordinary country, but it does have, as you say, so many different political, cultural, religious sort of, communities who aren't always living side by side in harmony. So have you been surprised by the response over the flooding?
Not at all, because we only had to see the tsunami that happened in 2004. And again, all the different communities gathered together. So it has not come as a surprise to me. But when this happens, it's heartwarming to know that our people haven't lost that community spirit and that that want to help others. That's still there. And for me, I'm so happy to see that.
And Tina, can I ask, is enough aid getting in, external aid? Are Sri Lankans getting the help they need to try and help recover and rebuild from this disaster?
Yes, our immediate neighbors, India, Pakistan, Maldives as well, they have all started sending aid. India and Pakistan have actually sent people to help with the recovery operations. Maldives has sent financial aid and also food and stuff. So people are supporting us. Then the Western governments, they have pledged money to help. So yes, we are getting much needed aid at the moment.
Do you know at the moment what the latest number is of the number of people missing after these floods?
The latest reports say approximately 550 people are missing or presumed dead.
Tina, what will be on a lot of people's minds is the issue, the sort of ever-growing issue of climate change. And is there a feeling across Sri Lanka and in the region that these storms and cyclones are getting worse because of climate change?
More climate change, yes, but more than that, before I came on the show, I was just doing some reading. And what I think the general consensus is that we need to plan our towns, cities, villages better and stop haphazardly building houses, etc., in areas that are prone to flooding and landslides. So past governments, they have allowed people to just willy-nilly build houses in areas that are now affected. So maybe going forward, our town planners need to seriously consider and get more strict legislature in to make sure that people build carefully or don't build in places that could potentially be underwater or be affected.
Do you think that's an issue?
But climate change, yes.
Sorry. Do you think talking about sort of logistical planning and construction development, is that an issue that's on the government's mind? Do they understand that, do you think?
I think they understand that, but officially they haven't made a statement as yet.
Okay, well, that is Tina Edward Gunawardana, a journalist and senior writer at Sri Lanka. Thank you for joining us from Colombo.
You're listening to Times Radio this afternoon. Our number is 0333 003 2353. It's been used again by Dominic, who says thank you. This is with regard to whether or not anyone could get banned for showing a photograph on the radio. Dominic adds, perhaps you could invite a mime artist in or somebody to do card tricks. And Andrew from Chiswick has used that number to say budget and cigar news. Any update on the reindeer? Calm down, cheeky boys. Coming up, MPs will investigate the Crown Estate after revelations of how little Prince Andrew, the former Prince Andrew, was paying in rent. We're going to get the benefit of Roya's royal knowledge on that story. And also in the next half an hour of the programme, we're going to be talking health news with Sarah Jarvis. You are listening to Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives, Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
So there have been so many questions about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's finances emerging over the last 12 months or so, not least concerning Royal Lodge a place where he has lived, paying a peppercorn rent, although he did pay millions of pounds for renovations to the lodge after he moved in. And we've had some very interesting news this afternoon, Roy, haven't we, about an inquiry that will look into this now and could possibly compel him to appear in front of MPs at a select committee. That would be astonishing, wouldn't it?
It would be astonishing. I don't know whether the Public Accounts Committee can actually compel a member of the royal family to appear, but they can certainly ask, and the expectation, if they do, will be huge on Andrew to do that. What has emerged this afternoon is correspondence that the Public Accounts Committee has published between the PAC, between the Crown Estate and the Treasury, with the Public Accounts Committee asking questions about how the lease on Royal Lodge came to be with the Crown Estate and the arrangement with the royal family. Now, for quite a long time now, since this has sort of been brewing, it's been very clear that a lot of people have felt very uneasy about how it came to be that, yes, Andrew paid millions when he first moved in there for renovations, but then paid a peppercorn rent. And the Crown Estate didn't make that known for a very long time, until actually it was George Greenwood on the Times finally got that out of them. But the interesting thing about what's come out now is that Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown has said, on the basis of what's come back in that correspondence, they have grounds for an inquiry. And the key thing, which is going to make uncomfortable reading for Buckingham Palace, is this word transparency, which he keeps talking about, because transparency has been the thing that I think sometimes the royal family has really struggled with, whether that's over money and the work that the Sunday Times did last year over the duchies, whether that's to do with properties, and certainly that has come to the fore with Andrew's arrangement over Royal Lodge.
Can you just explain the nature of the Crown Estate, who it is answerable to, what it actually stands for?
Well, the Crown Estate is a sort of vast property sort of portfolio, and there are all sorts of ways that it has arrangements with the royal family. The one that we deal with most is the way the sovereign grant is arranged. And the sovereign grant replaced the civil list many years ago, and that provides funding for the royal family for their official duties. So the way it stands at the moment, and has done since it was set up, is that the royal family get a percentage of the profits of the Crown Estate to go towards the running of their official duties. But it also, obviously, has come more to the fore. It oversees the tenancy arrangements that members of the royal family, like Andrew, like other members of the royal family, like Edward and Sophie, have over their properties. And actually, Bagshot Park, which is Edward and Sophie's property, is also mentioned in this correspondence. Of course, we had the story last week that Edward has been paying a peppercorn rent for that property too, although he did pay millions when he first moved in. So what I think the PAC are trying to do here is uncover more about how those arrangements have worked between the Crown Estate and the royal family, and understand how those things have come to be.
Is there any indication as to the time frame of this inquiry?
Yes. So what I've just been looking through the correspondence, and what the public accounts committee have said, is they will look to publish their inquiry in June next year. And after that, then they will start calling witnesses into an evidence session. And you know, you can assume that courtiers, people like keepers of the privy purse, and possibly Andrew McMahon-Windsor himself will be called forward to give evidence to that session.
Right. It'll be a fascinating watch, won't it?
I might be asking for a seat, Fee.
I think you should be front row. How do you think history is going to judge the way that the royal family has dealt with Andrew?
I think history will judge it before and after what we've just seen in the last couple of months. I mean, since I last, you know, was hanging out with you, a prince has been deprinced. And that very drastic action from the king was very different to how the queen handled it for many years. I think, you know, you and I have talked about the age of deference sort of sliding away when the late queen died. But I think with the king removing all of Andrew's titles and all his honours, I think the age of deference towards Andrew and the royal family has sort of evaporated. And I think people will judge the king's actions probably much more kindly than the late queen's. I think he just was her weak spot and she did not deal with it.
And that's such an interesting one, isn't it? Because I have felt that people have only wanted to very tentatively suggest that the queen might not have been as helpful as she could have been. And that is all to do with the place that she held in people's hearts. It is to do with an age of deference. But the further that we get away from the now, away from her passing, the easier it always becomes to criticise people, I think.
I would say it's not so much about the further we get away from Her Late Majesty's death. I think it's more to do with the more, you know, the here and now, what is now coming out and emerging. That is not to say that the late Queen knew every single thing that was in the Epstein files. She definitely didn't. But she knew there was a problem. She knew there was an issue. And that problem carried on and continued. And really, what the King did last month in October, removing his titles, the Queen really should have done back in 2019 after that Newsnight interview.
Yeah. What is going to happen to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor now? Do you think that he will keep his head down? Do you think he'll stay in this country?
I do think he'll stay in this country because I think he will want to be near his children and his grandchildren. He will try and keep his head down. You know, we know he's going to move to Sandringham in the new year. The problem for him is, with things like this, with things like the Public Accounts Committee in launching a new inquiry into his arrangements over Royal Lodge and an evidence session that goes into next year, it's going to keep coming up. The Epstein files will be released probably at some point in the next few months. Things are going to keep emerging. So he might logistically try and keep his head down, but he will continue to be in the news. And that is bad news and a problem for the King and for the future King.
It's fabulous that you are here today. Roy Onika always knows her stuff on the royal family. We're going to turn our attention to health news now for the last couple of moments before we head into the news bulletin. And Dr. Sarah Jarvis joins us to do that this week. Hello, Dr. Jarvis. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. We wanted to cover three stories with you, if we can. And the first one is about the use of laughing gas. And there was a really good piece in the paper this week about a clinical review that suggests that nitrous oxide can provide rapid relief from severe depression. But I thought on reading it that it's almost a dangerous thing to read because presumably the last thing you as a doctor want is for people to think, OK, I'll go and self-medicate with this stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And of course, we do know that laughing gas, when it's used as a recreational drug, and it often is, I'm sure we've all seen those little canisters on the street, can be very dangerous. You know, very dangerous to inhale direct from the canister, should never do it in an enclosed space. People who use too much of it, they can get asphyxiated because they don't have enough oxygen. And if you use it long term, then you can end up with really severe vitamin B12 deficiency, which can cause severe nerve damage, which sometimes is irreversible. So you're absolutely right. This is very much a question of don't do this at home. And we also do need to bear in mind that these were, I mean, potentially, I think, very exciting, but very exciting for future research, not very exciting for today. Thus far, there's only 7 clinical trials, 250 participants, so only tiny numbers in each study. They used different doses. You know, they had different inclusion and exclusion criteria. So we don't know who it's going to be best for. At the moment, the benefits were seen with 50% nitrous oxide in a single session. But the effects only lasted, they'd faded by a week. And of course, what we may see is that with repeated exposure in very controlled conditions, it may last longer, but we don't know that yet.
Okay. Let's talk about these other health stories too. Obviously, a very important one about a junior doctors, resident doctors strike over Christmas. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said that this is a very cynical attempt to wreck Christmas. What do you make of it?
I'm slightly torn on this one, I'll be entirely honest. I do know that junior doctors have enormous concerns. When I first became a junior doctor, I knew that the chances were I was going to get a job and I was going to be able to work throughout my career. We've now got 2-3 people applying for every single post and everybody else is really highly qualified. So there are lots of junior doctors who are finding it impossible to find work at the same time as we've got people desperate to see a doctor. So I think one of the things they were asking for is for this to be fixed. I have to say, in terms of money, I completely accept that over the course of the last 25 years or so, the wages of many doctors, GPs, as well as resident doctors, have gone down in real terms and just gone down and down and down and down in real terms, taking into account inflation. But resident doctors have had a pay rise of the best part of 30%. So, you know, I think that's kind of, I find it a bit more of a challenge than I did 2 years ago when this all started before
right.
They got that raise.
I mean, you're absolutely right to mention the pay award because, you know, so many people listening, Sarah, will think, well, you know, I'm scrabbling around to get an inflationary pay rise this year. And their recent pay award was 28%. I mean, to a lot of people, I think, that does seem like a very decent uptick.
You're absolutely right. But of course, we do need to bear in mind that that's against the backdrop of their pay going down and down and down in real terms compared to 25 years ago. It was about a third lower in real terms than it was 25 years ago. And if you think of the amount of training resident doctors undertake, one of the other things they're fighting for is that they currently have to take exams if they want to progress their careers. Their employers don't pay for them. And in most jobs, you know, careers, your employer, if they want you to continue and progress, will pay for your exams. They're paying out thousands of pounds for exams that they need to take if they're going to progress.
Right. Well, I'm sure it's a story that we will cover again. Let's make time for our last story, which is hugely important as well. Demand for ambulances rapidly rising as the flu season just gets worse. And this is a very bad flu season, isn't it? Can you just put it into some context for us?
Well, just to put it into perspective, you know, normally it's about 5,500 calls to London Ambulance Service in the course of a typical busy day, and we've had 3 days running where it was well over 7,000, in fact basically at the 7,500 rather than the 5,500 level. So an enormous increase, and much earlier in the year than we would normally see it. Now, that's against the background, certainly in London, only about half of people who are eligible for the flu vaccine on the NHS have so far taken it up. And it's also against a background of this flu virus having undergone a major change. So we know flu viruses change every year. Normally, we've got what we call drift. So there's little tiny changes in their makeup, in their genetic makeup. This year we've had the big one. We've had the shift. And when we've had pandemics before, it's always been because of a major shift.
Okay, so it is highly likely then that you can have had the jab, but you will still get the flu?
It's still thought that it's going to provide you with some protection, but it may not be as much protection as we've seen, as we see in other years, but it is still going to provide some protection.
I've only left you about 20 seconds to answer this, Sarah, but you're a talented professional. Here we go. At what point should you dial 999 and go to hospital?
If you are really, really struggling to breathe, if you genuinely can't catch your breath, or if you think that you've got sepsis. That's not to do with the flu, obviously. For instance, if you're coughing up red, if you're coughing up blood, or if you're coughing up rusty brown sputum, if you are too breathless to speak, if you've got a very high fever, if you become confused, if you're drifting in and out of consciousness, all of those things.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Dr. Pleasure. Sarah Jarvis.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio. We'll examine whether juries are effective as the Justice Secretary confirms they'll be scrapped in thousands of cases. Nearly half of women plan to skip Christmas parties over fears for their safety. We'll discuss the findings of the Angelini Inquiry. And our big interview today is with Dr. Chris Van Tulleken, speaking about his upcoming live show at the Royal Festival Hall. James Kitchen has the headlines at 3.
Thank you, Roy. Good afternoon. A report into the 1989 Hillsborough disasters found some police officers were guilty of complacency, failure and a concerted effort to blame fans. 97 Liverpool supporters died in the stadium crash, considered the most catastrophic event in British sporting history. The Independent Office for Police Conduct has now confirmed 12 senior officers would have had a case to answer for gross misconduct had they not retired before investigations began. Victims' families call it an injustice and have questioned the time taken to deliver the report. Sue Roberts, who's secretary of the Hillsborough Family Support Group, lost her brother in the disaster.
At least they've been named now. Their families can feel the shame of what went on. Sadly, for far too many families, we've lost parents and they died tormented because they knew the extent of the cover-up.
An inquiry has found sexually motivated crimes against women in public are not afforded the same response as other high-priority offences. The review was ordered following the murder of Sarah Everard by an off-duty police officer in 2021. The report chair, Lady Eilish Angelini, warned of critical gaps in the prevention of violence against women. She's called for urgent action, telling political leaders quite simply, get a move on. There are lives at stake.
With a greater spotlight on the safety of women in public, women should feel safer in public spaces.
but many do not. Women change their travel plans, their routines, and their lives out of fears for their safety in public, while far too many perpetrators continue to roam freely. Women deserve to feel safer. They deserve to be safer. Making women safer should make everyone safer.
The Commons Public Accounts Committee has announced it's to launch an inquiry into the Crown Estate. It follows questions over the organisation's lease of Royal Lodge to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Last month, the Times revealed the former prince had been paying a peppercorn rent for the Windsor mansion. He's now to live on the Sandringham estate. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy's, announced juries will be scrapped in England and Wales for defendants facing a sentence of 3 years or less. Magistrates will also be handed more powers to reduce court backlogs. Meanwhile, it's been confirmed 12 prisoners have been mistakenly released from jails in the past 3 weeks. It's understood two are still on the run. And Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff has landed in Moscow ahead of talks with Jared Kushner and Vladimir Putin on ending the war in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Volodymyr Zelensky has been speaking alongside the Irish Prime Minister in Dublin. The Ukrainian president announced the original US peace proposal has been narrowed to a 20-point plan. Earlier, he said Kyiv is committed to constructive cooperation with President Trump's team, but warned that Russia was using talks as a way to weaken sanctions. The former Ukrainian MP Hannah Hopko told Times Radio she's not expecting any positive developments from any US-led negotiations.
Europe must lead, not always look at the White House and to see how Trump and his Witkoff and other guys who just want to make money, who just want to profit from this war. And it's not in the interest of European security.
And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thank you for your messages this afternoon. It's Fee Glover and Roy Nika with you until 4 o'clock. Can I just do a little bit of a parish notice? Because Liz has texted in to say, apologies if I missed it, but I've just received an email to say that the event at the Prince Edward's Theatre on Sunday with Jane and Fear has been cancelled. Is that correct? Liz, it is, unfortunately. Jane is up in Crosby with her family this week and won't be able to come back down on Sunday. So if you do have a ticket to come and see our live show, it will be fully refunded and we will try and regroup in the springtime of 2026. Plenty to talk about in this hour of the programme, and after 3:30, you may well be a big fan of Professor Chris Van Tulleken. He is no stranger to the airwaves here at Times Radio. He always has some very thoughtful things to say, particularly about ultra-processed food. Today is no different, but he's also talking about Operation Ouch, which is a show that him and his twin brother Zand do together, trying to get kids really involved in health and understanding their bodies. This particular iteration of it, it's on at the Royal Festival Hall over the Christmas season, is going in search of a Jurassic fart. I just place that in your mind. I won't say that word too often because there'll be kids, won't there, with you at this time of day going, she said it so I can say it, so my apologies. At least it's not 6-7. Okay. The right to a jury trial across England and Wales will be limited in a wide variety of cases, allowing juries only in the most serious cases like murder, rape and manslaughter. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, told MPs why he is making this change.
Our world-leading judges should hear the most serious cases, and I agree that they and the magistracy should decide where a case is heard. This will prevent defendants from gaming the system, choosing whichever court they think gives the best chance of success and drawing out the process, hoping victims give up. And I will limit appeals from the magistrates' court so that they are only allowed on points of law to prevent justice being delayed further.
Well, David Lammy also told Times Radio Breakfast it'll take years to clear the backlog of delayed cases in the courts. Joining us is criminal barrister Alex McBride, known for his expert commentary on the jury on Channel 4. Good afternoon from us, Alex. I wonder whether you can just give us your initial thoughts about this massive change to the criminal justice system.
I think it's a terrible idea. It's some ultra-processed justice that they want. And it won't fix what they say it will. And that's my real problem with it. It's not going to make any difference to the backlog. And it will just mean that we'll have a less robust and less fair justice system.
Why wouldn't it make a difference to the backlog?
Well, the reason we have a backlog is not because of juries. This is just nonsense. We have a backlog because there were years and years of austerity, and the Ministry of Justice cut the number of courts we have, Blackfriars Court, Crown Court in London, purpose-built court with nine courts was closed. I have no idea why they did that, other than perhaps to save money. They have the same problem with barristers. There are fewer barristers and there are not enough judges. So there are just not the people to be able to make the criminal justice system work. So the jury seems to me to be neither here nor there. You can't have a criminal justice system without people to make it work. And if you haven't got a criminal justice system that is properly staffed and properly resourced, it won't work, no matter whether you have juries or trial by combat. Or trial by ordeal.
So all of those things that you've just told us about a creaking criminal justice system, is that why there has been a reducing productivity in courts?
Yeah, so just so your viewers and listeners can understand, there are lots of elements that go into a criminal trial. I mean, of course there are. But one of the main things is getting the defendant to come to court. If they're on remand, they have to be brought to court. Often no one brings the defendant to court, so you can't have a trial because the defendant isn't there. That is not the jury's fault. Indeed, you can have problems with where the system, the digital system for the cases, freezes. That happens all the time. And again, that's got nothing to do with the jury, and it means you can't have a trial, and people are left twiddling their thumbs in the back rock, and the backlog just gets worse and worse.
But it must simply take more time to select a jury, to get a jury in, to allow a jury to hear complex cases. Would it not be the case that a judge would be able to speed up that process at all?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I have seen many juries being panelled in court. It doesn't take very much time. It takes about 15 minutes. But I have spent days. I've lost days and weeks waiting for defendants to be produced. I've lost days and weeks of my life staring at my shoes, waiting for witnesses to be found, waiting for interpreters to be brought to court who haven't been booked. The system doesn't work because it's not properly resourced. It seems ludicrous to blame the jury. Imagine the metaphor is this. You've got a car, which is the criminal justice system. It's sitting on blocks. Someone's taken the steering wheel. And David Lammy's coming along and saying, well, if we put a go faster stripe down the side of the car, it's going to work just fine. It's just not true.
Right. Well, it's a very decent analogy. And thank you for planting that in our minds. The Justice Secretary gives the example, though, Alex McBride, of someone who's stolen two iPhones from Currys, asking whether that person should have a trial in front of a jury. Is there something about the changing nature of crime that we should put into this argument? Should that person demand the attention of 12 good men and true?
If that person wishes to have a trial by jury, I don't see what the problem is with that. A trial like that could take half a day. There's no reason why that couldn't be done extremely quickly. The witnesses wouldn't be difficult. The CCTV evidence, there's likely to be CCTV evidence in this case, wouldn't be hard to put together. To say that things like that are slowing down the criminal justice system just simply is not true. And the problem I have with this is that we have David Lammy, we have the Labour government, and we have politicians saying this is going to transform the criminal justice system. It won't. We'll still have the same broken system, except we won't have juries anymore. It's always very interesting to me. People always have a good reason to take away your freedoms. And this is a freedom and a right that we have enjoyed for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it stops overweening state power, and it also forces the advocates like me and judges to make a case intelligible to people who are being tried and witnesses who are coming to give evidence. We have to make it intelligible because the jury has to understand it, and that means we understand the case and we can present it in a clear and proper way, and that is vitally important.
I have been intrigued and an enormous fan of the Channel 4 programme The Jury, which you have participated in too as an expert giving commentary on the programme. Now, for people who haven't seen it, it takes a very simple notion. It takes a trial that has already come to fruition with a real jury, and it replaces the real jury with people who are taking part in a TV version being a jury, and it puts before them quite a lot of the evidence the original jury had. Now, it hasn't always come to the same conclusion, has it, than the original jury did? And that tells us something about the nature of the jury that surely we should be quite concerned about.
Yes, you will always, I mean, there's no getting away from it. Any criminal justice system, determining guilt and innocence, there's an element of luck, I suppose, if I can put it like that. You know, you do spin the wheel of justice. That is certainly true. But if you're going to spin the wheel of justice, you want to do it in the fairest possible way. And remember, the jury murder trial is brilliant. I'm honoured to advise them, but it is not a real jury. It is not a real case. And in my experience, I've had a lot of experience in the criminal courts, juries very, very infrequently come up with a verdict which can't be seen to be fair and robust.
We've had anecdotal evidence from listeners since this story broke who have sat on juries and have said of their other jurors, actually, they couldn't wait to get away at the end of the day. They wanted to know when the coffee break was, when the lunch break was. And there were huge problems for an awful lot of people about the fact that they had been asked to give up their time for expenses that weren't covering their weekly outgoings. And, you know, there definitely is evidence that a lot of people try and get out of jury service. It doesn't seem entirely fit for purpose.
Well, certainly people try and get out of it. One of the biggest laughs we get in the criminal courts is listening to frightfully important middle-class people saying that they can't possibly do this trial. And happily, judges normally ignore this because it is a duty as to our fellow citizens to sit in judgment upon them. Is a very important principle in our criminal justice system. It also ties our country together and ties citizens together to do something that I would say is probably the most empowering thing you could possibly do. People talk about feeling powerless, talk about how things don't work. Well, the jury does work, and it is empowering, and it enables the public to see that justice is done and is done fairly.
Yeah. Do you think that most jurors are very enthusiastic and enter the courtroom with that kind of mental state?
Well, I don't think it's the last day of school where kids are going on their holiday enthusiastic, but I have seen in courts up and down the country jurors take their duty incredibly seriously, and I like to think an enormous amount of them have found it very rewarding. They sit, people from all walks of life sit together and they consider the evidence that has been presented. And they come up to a fair verdict, a true verdict, according to the evidence that they have heard. Mm-hmm. And I think for the country and for society, that's enormously, enormously powerful.
Can I ask you about some of the other problems within the criminal justice system? There is a problem with an ageing workforce, also a huge drop in numbers. Since 2010, a 46% drop in the number of magistrates. How do you turn that around?
That is a very good question. They're going to have to go out and encourage people to do it. They should get younger people to do it. You want people being tried, whether it's in the magistrates' court in front of lay justices or a district judge, or in the Crown Court in front of a judge and jury. You want people to be tried by their peers. So that's people who look like them. We live in a multicultural society. Generally, people who are younger tend to get caught up in the criminal justice system, and we should have younger people sitting in judgment too, who really understand their backgrounds and understand that the age they are. And I would say that they would do it much more fairly than, you know, a 60-something judge.
David Lammy made a point today of using the example of somebody who has been raped, and he actually planted in the listeners' minds on an interview on Times Radio Breakfast the notion that that could happen to anyone, probably to any woman, tonight, and then that person might find themselves waiting for justice for up to 4 years. Something massive has to change, doesn't it, for that victim to feel that they are going to get justice and that they do not have to spend 4 years waiting for that to happen. Is there a better way that you could imagine helping that person?
Absolutely. I entirely agree with what you suggest in your question. That is an utter disgrace that someone has to wait for 4 years for a trial to happen. The reason that these trials are delayed have got nothing to do with juries. They've got to do with successive governments, particularly the last Conservative government and its 14 years of failing to fund the criminal justice system properly, but leaving not enough courts, not enough specialist rape and sexual offence prosecutors, not enough judges, and just not a system that can cope with getting people through it quickly. That is not the jury's fault. That is because we as a society are not prepared to fund our system.
Thank you for talking to us this afternoon. That is criminal barrister Alex McBride. Lots of you have got thoughts on this too. This one comes from Chris in Fleet, who says, just because we've had something for 100 years, it doesn't mean it's the best system. We used to have rickets and there's no nostalgia for that either. And Vincent said, would turkeys want 2 Christmas days each year? Are barristers thinking about their fees if we reduce the number of jury cases? And Jan just says, sorry, this chap is talking nonsense. 0333 003 2353 is our number this afternoon.
Coming up, we'll look further into the investigation into Royal Lodge, which is breaking news this afternoon. It is 18 minutes past three, and this is Fee Glover and Warrenika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Carol Walker on Times Radio.
The Justice Secretary announces plans to scrap jury trials for crimes which carry a sentence of less than 3 years. We'll discuss whether it will speed up the justice system or undermine an important principle. President Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff is meeting President Putin in Moscow. We'll have the latest on the negotiations to try to end the war in Ukraine, and we'll take you through the front pages of tomorrow's papers.
Carol Walker. Tonight from 10 on Times Radio.
Step inside number 9 for a final time with me, Steve Pemberton.
And me, Rhys Shearsmith, as we bring inside number 9 Stage Fright back to London for our final shows.
Expect the unexpected from the 2nd to the 6th of January at the Eventim Apollo Hammersmith.
Inside number 9 must end. Don't miss your final chance to see us live.
I think it's live.
Sorry, live.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Some great thoughts about jury trials being abolished, bar the most serious crimes. Sarah says, barristers may laugh at people trying to get out of jury trials, but for many people already juggling jobs, a small business, caring for children, the elderly, animals, to be told you have to be away every day for at least 2 weeks is a real issue. Multiply that by 12, and that's just for one shoplifting case. Jury trials are hopelessly inefficient. I don't often agree with David Lammy, but he is spot on with this. And a very similar one from Douglas, who says the jury system isn't fit for purpose. It's a legal tradition that only a small group of countries still rely on heavily. Most people I've spoken to about doing jury service said it was extremely time consuming, with a lot of sitting around and jurors worried about who is doing their day job. while they are away. Douglas and Sarah, I think many people have exactly that experience of jury service. And in a changing economy where so many people are freelance or they're on 0 hours contracts, it is a very difficult thing to ask of people to turn up in court every day. Right, that takes us to 21 minutes to three.
MPs will investigate the Crown Estate after The Times revealed Andrew Mountbatten Windsor hadn't paid rent on his Royal Lodge property in 2 decades. The investigation will be carried out by Parliament's Public Accounts Committee, as we said earlier. Well, we're hoping to be joined shortly by Clive Betts, who is the Labour MP for Sheffield South East and a member of the committee. But just to recap, the breaking news this afternoon that the Public Accounts Committee has been writing to the Crown Estate and to the Treasury, has received correspondence back, and off the back of that correspondence has announced it's going to launch an inquiry into the lease arrangements over Royal Lodge. I'm delighted to say we are joined by Clive Betts. Clive, thank you so much for joining us on this breaking news story. We've seen some of the correspondence this afternoon. Can you tell me why the PAC has decided to launch this inquiry into the arrangements over Royal Lodge?
Well, in the end, ultimately, all members of the Public Accounts Committee are members of Parliament, and we are accountable to the public in our roles. And I think there is a public interest in this. Clearly, you're in the media as a radio station. Many other parts of the media have drawn attention to this. And there is clearly a lot of interest amongst our constituents about the matters. Not to say we've reached conclusions, but there's interest, and therefore having an interest in these matters means looking at them and doing an inquiry is the right way to proceed.
Now, some of the phrasing in the letters between Sir Geoffrey Clifton-Brown, who's the chair of the PAC, and the Treasury, there's the word that keeps coming up is transparency. Can I ask where you feel perhaps the Crown Estate and possibly the Royal Family or members of the Royal Family around their lease arrangements perhaps have not been as transparent as they could have been?
Well, I don't think we've reached that conclusion. And what the Public Accounts Committee does is to look at all the evidence, consider it, ask questions of the National Audit Office, who do the audit of the Crown Estate, for example, and come to a view based on the evidence we have. So I'm not going to be drawn into assumptions and views at this stage without having seen all the evidence. So we're not talking about lack of transparency. What we're saying is transparency is important. And I think anyone who looks at this immediately will say the relationships between the Crown Estate and the Royal House and the Treasury are certainly complicated, and dealing with that complication is one of the issues that the committee will look at.
Sir Geoffrey mentions that after the inquiry is published, hopefully in June of next year, there will be an evidence session and witnesses will be called to give evidence in that evidence session. Can I ask who you would look to give evidence there, and might you request the presence of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, given he has been the tenant in Royal Lodge?
You're tempting me to talk about decisions the committee hasn't made once again.
I merely asked a question, Clive.
I know you've asked the question, and my answer will be the committee will come to that at the time. At this stage, the inquiry hasn't happened. We haven't seen the results of that inquiry. We therefore haven't decided how we will conduct the hearings that we will have and who we will call as witnesses. So we are some way off that yet. It's probably going to be June time by the time we get to that point. To make sure we've done this correctly and properly. And that's what the committee will do.
Mr. Betts, it's Fee Glover here. I'm going to try coming in at a different angle on that question.
Right.
Is there any reason that a member of the royal family would not be called before a parliamentary committee? What's the precedent on this?
Well, first of all, you know, you're talking about members of the royal family, and you know, there aren't, I think, precedents. There aren't rules. The committee will look at the situation as it is. It will look at the situation with regard to the individual who's been renting the Royal Lodge. His status has clearly changed. Now, whether that therefore changes how the committee may deal with that is a matter the committee will deal with at the time.
You mentioned your constituents, you mentioned people feeling that they needed answers. Have you actually, as an MP and with your role on the committee, received correspondence from people saying, I'm really fed up with this, you look into it for me?
Yes, I mean, we get constituents write to us about every possible issue all the time. We also listen to our colleagues in Parliament, not just ourselves, about what constituents are asking of them. And clearly, a lot of our colleagues in Parliament have had constituents raise the concerns about this. So given that the Crown Estate is audited by the National Audit Office, it's something they do every year, this is a completely appropriate area for the committee to explore.
They'd want to see Andrew answer questions, wouldn't they?
They may want to. Whether that's appropriate at the time is something the committee will get to at that time.
Right. I can't think of another angle at which to come at the same question, Mr. Betts. So I think we hear you loud and clear. But it may well be an extraordinary thing to witness. Would you at least grant us that?
You said it would be an extraordinary thing. I'll wait till the time comes to see how we go ahead with this.
Right. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. Clive Betts is Labour MP for Sheffield South East and a member of the committee. Whether or not Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor would appear in front of that committee, I think an awful lot of people listening this afternoon, Roy, will just say, about time, that there was just more of a pushback on these opaque finances, on this world of reverence that actually does afford an awful lot of people a very gilded cage in which to live.
I think actually what Clive touched on there as well was the point that given that Andrew's status is so dramatically changed in the last few months, I think that may embolden the committee to call him, I'm conjecturing here, and I think a lot of people, it ramps up the pressure on him. He no longer has the protection of being, you know, a titled member of the royal family. He is still the king's brother. But I think there will be much more of an expectation as to say, he is the person who's been living there. He is the person who arranged this, you know, arrangement with the Crown Estate over his lease. Why wouldn't he give evidence? And I think that will be something that the PAC will probably find in their favour should they choose to call him. But to your point about, will he try and keep his head down? This inquiry means he is not going to be able to keep his head down. Even if he doesn't appear, it is going to keep it front and centre in the news.
And is there a part of you as a journalist that is really cheering from the rafters today? Because it is as if two different parts of the estate that makes up the constitution of this country are at last kind of coming together. You know, journalists like yourself and colleagues on The Times and Sunday Times have done some superb work about royal finances, haven't they? And now we will actually see it being approached by Parliament.
I think this is fascinating. I mean, I did a podcast recently on this very issue with Andrew and his house, and we had George Greenwood on, who has done so much great reporting and finally got that unredacted lease. But my goodness me, took him a long time to get it out of the Crown Estate. And, you know, we were probing as to who has obstructed that? Why did that take so long to get? And he said, you know, I don't really know why, but I think this is really interesting. It takes it on a step further.
It is superb to have your thoughts on that this afternoon. We'd love to hear from all of you out there about it too, 0333 003 2353. So we're going to head towards 3:30. I said it was 21 minutes to 3 instead of 21 minutes past 3 about 10 minutes ago. And my deepest and most sincere apologies if that meant that you thought, yeah, I'll have another cup of tea, I'll stay in bed, I'll lie on the sofa for 40 minutes. I was completely out. It is 3:30. Our big interview next is with UPF expert, Dr. and Professor Chris Van Tulleken on his new show. Let's go to check on the latest news headlines first with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Commons Public Accounts Committee has announced it's to launch an inquiry into the Crown Estate. It follows questions over the organisation's lease of Royal Lodge to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy's, announced juries will be scrapped in England and Wales for defendants facing a sentence of 3 years or less. Magistrates will also be handed more powers in a bid to reduce court backlogs. An inquiry into the murder of Sarah Everards found sex offences against women are not given the same response as other high-priority crimes. Its report concludes violence prevention schemes are often just words. Zoe Billingham's a former chief inspector of police forces.
Not sufficient progress has been made. Women still can't be safe. The burden of keeping them safe is still being pushed onto women themselves. And there now needs to be a relentless focus on the men that cause the harm, the perpetrators and the predators.
And investigations found 12 police officers would have been disciplined for gross misconduct over the Hillsborough disaster had they still been serving. It's after the Independent Office for Police Conduct examined the police's handling of the 1989 tragedy in which 97 people died. And Vladimir Putin claims European leaders are making demands for peace in Ukraine, which the Kremlin considers unacceptable. Donald Trump's negotiators Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are in Moscow for talks. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Step inside number nine for a final time with me, Steve Pemberton.
And me, Rhys Shearsmith, as we bring Inside Number Nine Stage Fright back to London for our final shows.
Expect the unexpected from the 2nd to the 6th of January at the Eventim Apollo Hammersmith.
Inside Number Nine must end. Don't miss your final chance to see us live.
I think it's live.
Sorry, live.
Think about cheese. Make your thoughts cheesier. Now add 100% chicken breast fillet, chipotle sauce and a mega cheese melt. And it's giving the new cheesy chicken stack at McDonald's. Did we mention it's cheesy?
Cheese!
Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wickes.co.uk.
Professor Van Tulleken, Chris Van Tulleken, has become a firm and important voice in our food world. Talking about the dangers of ultra-processed food, he argues that UPFs contribute to a pandemic of chronic diseases, calling them industrial-produced edible substances rather than actual food. And with his twin brother, Zand, who's also a doctor, he's made several TV series about the state of our health. They've got a podcast. They also do a show together called Operation Ouch, which is aimed at giving kids in particular a better understanding of health and their bodies. It's in its 13th series. And its latest iteration is a live show on at the Royal Festival Hall in London over the festive season. The full title is Operation Ouch, Quest for the Jurassic Fart. We started by talking about just how far this quest has taken him.
It's a proper quest. My identical twin brother, Zand, my co-presenter, has written it, which means that I am then the victim of his various projects on this journey. So we're on a journey to find the most valuable fart in history, far from the late Cretaceous era, actually. All the good dinosaurs are from the Cretaceous period. So we're on a journey to find a Cretaceous fart. All the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, also from the Cretaceous period. And it's, if you like, dinosaurs, farts, explosions, lasers, medicine, science, or you just want us to look after your kids for an hour and 20 minutes, those are all valid reasons to come to the show. Operation Ouch is now 15 years old, so we've had hen parties or people getting married who grew up with Operation Ouch, and we have a whole variety of people in the audience. So it's a good journey.
What would a Jurassic fart have smelt like?
I think pretty dungy. So the big herbivores were what we call... So the real farters that probably committed and contributed significantly to global climate change during the three eras of the giant reptiles fermented their food in pretty similar ways to modern hindgut fermenters, we think. So quite cow-like. So I'm going to say dungy. But I think if you went back, there'd be notes that you wouldn't recognise. I think it'd be quite a particular smell. Yeah.
Yeah.
What a great question. No one's ever asked me that before.
Have they not? I love the idea that you could have kind of tasting notes on a fart. I mean, do you think they
don't
have...
you? Any two-headed podcast, surely you do this in the booth.
No, we're smells ladies. Like one of Jane's. No, Chris, we're ladies. We never break wind. We never even use the word fart. But you must be able to tell an awful lot. Obviously, you can about somebody's diet through what their farts. Should we just call it wind? Actually, we're on Times Radio.
Yeah,
what their wind smells like.
Let's
so
shift
through
the narrative.
Time, that wind would have changed a lot.
I think one of the really big themes of the show is, as well as trying to teach kids about the science of their gastrointestinal system, because all kids' first experience of the, I think it's legitimate to say that the kind of miracle of life is putting food in one end and it coming out very transformed at the other as wind and solid. And so a part of the show is explaining that science. A part of the show is getting them to confront the embarrassment that surrounds that kind of science, because embarrassment is a very dominant emotion in kids' lives. And so a lot of the show is providing them with the agency that if they can talk about things like farts, but including then injuries, other medical problems, that will empower them. And also getting them to think a little bit about what we might be able to tell from looking at poo and farts, which, as you say, is an important an important thing to do without obsessing over it.
It's such a good point about taking away the embarrassment. And actually, recently there has been a highly commended toilet paper advert, which puts a kid in school who clearly has been very embarrassed in the past about having a poo at school. And the advert, you know, gives him the roll of toilet paper and he goes, yeah, I'm off for a poo. And as any parent who's had school age kids knows, that's actually turned into a huge thing at school. Not wanting to go and use the toilets for loads of reasons. And sometimes toilets actually being locked during lesson time so kids can't go. And you're right, I mean, it's a natural phenomenon. We should be way past being embarrassed about it.
We know from more than a decade of Ouch that the kids who watch it, we get this feedback from colleagues, people writing in, that they are better able to confront embarrassing scenarios to do with their own body, but also disgusting scenarios to do with their own bodies or other people's bodies. It's very important if you want to be a scientist or a doctor or a biologist. Professionally, you need to do that. If your parent or loved one collapses in front of you because they bang their head and there's blood everywhere, it's great if you can help and not pass out yourself. And it's really good if when you have an odd lump on a lumpy bit of your body, if you can go and, without any embarrassment, go and see your doctor or other healthcare practitioner. So the show is partly about the kind of science of embarrassment, but it's trying to get kids to understand embarrassment more than any other emotion is the emotion that shapes our moment-to-moment behaviour, like you and I right now. And it's good. It stops me doing all kinds of things I shouldn't do on Times Radio, but it can also stop you going on the radio in the first place and stop you doing lots of things that you want to and need to achieve. Mm. So our other commitment to this hour and 20 minutes is your kids will leave at the end better able to handle emotions, and while there's lots of chances for screaming, they end up a little calmer by the end.
Right, it does sound like the perfect antidote to the usual Christmas fare as well. Is there a little bit of the kind of the slightly rebellious schoolboy in both of you that goes, yeah, there are no Chris Dingles in our show. It's just about bodies and poo and farts. Welcome to Christmas.
It's fun at the moment. The best bit of performing live, and we've done various live shows. I do think this is the best. We've done, I think, six now, and Zond takes the burden of writing it each year. But it's walking up to the precipice of acceptability where there are a few people thinking, oh, we're not sure if they're really going to be able to do this. And also getting the kids to an extreme and then persuading them to rein themselves back in. And so trying to have the audience on a little bit of a yo-yo is fun. And we're usually able to do it, but there's always that slight tension in the show of whether
it might just tip over.
Yeah, it's never happened yet. We've done, I don't know, many, many hundreds of shows.
Well, there's a challenge for your
but
audience.
Come to the Royal Festival Hall and see if you can bring the house down.
Can I ask you about that very strange place that we find ourselves in, where we have access to more knowledge and information about food than we have ever had in the history of the planet, but yet the choices that so many of us make would show quite a high level of ignorance about what we're eating and how we're eating. What's happened?
I think I reject the premise of the question because you used the word choice. The food we eat, for people really isn't much of a choice. I frame it in quite an extreme way, and people push back against this, but I think you have very little more choice about the food you eat, for most people this is true, than you do about the air you breathe or the water you drink. It's determined by your culture, your friends, the food that's served to you at your institution if you're a child, the food that's served to you by your parents, and primarily by your budget. And in the UK, our food budget is squeezed down. We spend a lower proportion of household income on food than we do on than almost any other European country. In fact, I think than any other European country. It's about 6-7%. And that's not because we're being extravagant. It's because our other costs are so high. So these things aren't choices. But I love your point that somehow in the midst of all the information, we have become more ignorant in a way. And I think it speaks to, there's a concept of nutritional wisdom that actually there are experiments. I mean, you can run the experiment with a wild animal. Wild animals are incredibly able to, without reading instruction ingredients lists or nutritional information, they balance their calorific intake exquisitely over a lifetime, so that instances of obesity are simply non-existent, even in situations of abundance. But they also manage to get enough cobalt and manganese and selenium and iron and copper and all the other things they need to survive. Humans seem to have lost this nutritional wisdom, although experiments in the 1920s showed that we still have it. If you give babies an array of whole and minimally processed foods, they will pick from them and maintain complete health. If you give them salt, they won't overdose on the salt. And I think that the headline really is that most of our food now in the UK, most of our calories are ultra processed. And what that means is they are constructed in a way that is about maximizing profit and marketability and convenience. And so they're processed in the interests of the people who make them, not the people who receive them. And that makes them completely different to all the food we've ever eaten. And so as well as being nutritionally depleted, and we have very good knowledge that they're micronutrient deficient, they're fiber deficient, they're often protein deficient, they're also engineered so you eat a huge amount of them. So what we're seeing is this burden of diet-related disease, where it's not just the same communities that experience micronutrient deficiency and malnutrition alongside obesity, it's the same bodies. So we see stunting hand in hand with calorific excess.
What does weight loss drugs do to all of that? Do you worry that actually it just creates a completely false dawn where you haven't tackled any of those things that you've just talked about? You've just put a pharmaceutical solution on top of a commerce-driven problem.
I think of the new GLP-1 agonists and the other similar drugs, people will have heard of them, as being pretty similar to chemotherapy for lung cancer. So it's great. We should absolutely have chemotherapy for lung cancer. People get lung cancer because they smoke, and they then need operations and medication to treat that, radiotherapy. And we should invest in all of that. That budget should not distract us from all the upstream public health interventions that prevent people getting lung cancer in the first place. So essentially the regulation of the tobacco industry. And there is a difficulty that if we muddle up treatment and prevention and start thinking about them as, you know, being in the same, having the same sort of budget priority, we can get in a real pickle. We cannot prescribe these drugs to children from birth, and nor should we. We're not giving them to kids under the age of 10. And yet we know that in some communities in the UK, the average by the age of 10 for obesity is 25%. In some places, one in three children is living with obesity by the age of 10, and they're stunted compared to their Northern European counterparts. So the drugs are great. We should spend money on them. We should negotiate very hard about the price, but they are not a substitute. Also, they fix obesity. They don't fix anything else. So they're not a substitute for feeding our kids well at school. That seems, is that controversial? I don't think I'm off piece saying that.
No, I don't think it's controversial at all, but I wonder what your thoughts are about our direction of travel, whether or not you feel that actually we have a health secretary at the moment who might be very drawn to weight loss drugs solving the nation's problem of obesity, and might have to literally look at the books and go, right, I'm going to put the money there. I'm not going to put it into all of the programs that might re-educate a child child's palate or make their childhood healthier and therefore their adult life healthier.
Well, he's in an invidious position because the benefits you get from the weight loss drugs happen within an electoral cycle. And it takes a little longer, not substantially longer, to get the benefits from feeding kids well from birth. You know, investing massively in the first 1,000 days of life, which include pregnancy, there is no period of life. I mean, UNICEF have done great campaigning on this. First Steps Nutrition have. If you spend £1 on those first 1,000 days, you get that paid back so many more than any other pound you can invest in the health service. But it's complicated. There are, you know, it's not how in an ideal world we would spend our money, but there are lots of political complexities that I'm sure other people can speak to.
Are you quite hopeful about what future generations might be more capable of doing in terms of nutrition and health?
I think I have to be because I'm a food systems academic at UCL, and I spend my life both studying the food system and advocating for it to be improved. There are some real sources of hope. So we have, I think, a growing sense that the ultra-processed food industry isn't just similar to the tobacco industry. For a long time, it was the same industry. They were the same companies. The cigarette companies owned the big food companies that we know. And so I think we have a regulatory template that isn't identical, but we can use the same approaches. I think one of the real problems that we see in the UK is that there are financial conflicts of interest between every single institution that might regulate the ultra-processed food industry and the companies themselves, whether that's government guideline committees, scientific expert committees, academic journals, research units, our biggest food charities, our media communication centres. All of it is funded by the relatively small number of companies that feed us. So that was what we ended with tobacco first, is we said if we're going to solve this problem, put warning labels on packs and effectively tax things, you need to speak to industry, you have to understand their limitations, and food is more complicated than tobacco, but you can't have industry holding your pen while you write policy.
Do you think we'd ever get to the stage where a packet of smoked bacon does have some kind of a symbol on it in the same way that cigarettes have horrible images of what smoking can do to a body?
So there's line detail on policy about what warning label you should put on. We have what's very clear is from my colleagues in South and Central America is lots of these countries are doing this and they're doing it really well. And you do need warning labels on food, but that's just the beginning. So if you have a box of chocolate flavoured cereal with a cartoon character on the pack, if it has a warning label, that's the first, you know, because it's too high in fat, salt, sugar, calories. That's how you put warning labels on food. Once it gets a warning label, that cartoon character comes off the box. All the claims about supporting your family's health and for a source of fibre, those claims come off the box. You can't sell it to kids. It's not in schools. You can't market it in a place where a child might see it. So you bring in these sort of 360-degree policies. I think we're a really long way from it in the UK. But I think there is growing public appetite. And we've seen this. We are inching toward putting effective sugar taxes on things. And we know that sugar taxes really work.
Mm. Sugar taxes are so interesting, though, aren't they, Chris? Because, I mean, it just proves that the certain parts of the food industry have just been unwilling to serve their customers well. If you have to wait for a financial imperative that slices your profits in order to change the amount of sugar you put into a food, you're not a particularly great company, are you? But I'm not sure that we really have called the companies out enough over that. Would you agree?
That's interesting. I think that misunderstands what the function of a modern publicly limited corporation is, which is to deliver shareholder value. I mean, that's their stated purpose. And it's very hard for them to not do that or to do things which challenge that. So I'm quite sympathetic to the companies. I'm less sympathetic to the people whose stated primary purpose is not to make money from selling sugary drinks or chocolate bars. It's the doctors, the influencers, the scientists, the government policymakers whose stated primary purpose is to look after public interest, but they have a financial relationship with a company whose primary purpose is to sell sugary drinks. So there's never really been a history, an example, at least I can't think of an example, and I've studied this a lot, of a single corporation that's acted in the public interest against its own financial interest. Companies do lots of good things, but it's very hard. If I'm making money from selling confectionery, and so is my competitor, it's very, very hard for me to make confectionery that is less desirable, which is ultimately what is in the public interest, is that we all eat less, fewer sweets. That's the bottom line. Very hard for a sweet company to go, well, we're just going to take money away from our owners.
Sure.
And the owners are generally pension funds.
But I suppose I'm thinking, let's just take the milk drinks, because that's the latest place where the sugar tax is going to appear, isn't it? And I'm just wondering about the company that decides, yeah, well, we'll have a 200 milliliter bottle of vanilla milkshake that's got 6 spoonfuls of sugar in it, where they could quite easily have put 3 spoons of sugar in it. And do you think it really wouldn't have sold as well with all the influencers behind it, all of the advertising campaigns, the coolness of it, put some protein in, get a whole other audience involved?
It's hard to speak to a specific milkshake, but I've spent a lot of the last few years speaking to technologists inside food companies. They're developing milkshakes, ice creams, using every imaginable technique under the sun. They put people in brain scanners to look at their responses to ice cream and soft drinks. So if they've said it's 6 spoonfuls of sugar, they have worked that out to within, down to the last, you know, single granule of sugar in there. They figured that out very, very precisely. They're not doing it casually. Everything from the texture of the bottle to the logo on it, every single aspect of every product is optimized for maximum consumption. And this is the point about ultra-processed food. We showed this, we launched it, a big series of papers in The Lancet 2 weeks ago, the biggest series on ultra-processed food so far. And what we show is that ultra-processed foods are displacing traditional foods that don't have that as their purpose. When you cook food at home, food that's been cooked for generations, maybe millennia, its purpose was not to make money. That wasn't the original purpose of tomatoes or meat or, you know, a curry or a pizza. And it's when we turn it into ultra-processed food, then its purpose changes. And that's the most important thing to understand about ultra-processed food. The products are less important than we are seeing the displacement of traditional diets all over the world. And that is ultimately the project of the ultra-processed food industry, to get rid of all traditional food.
What will you have for Christmas lunch?
So I make an exception on Christmas Day, because I think what's really important is to spend time with your family. So when it's my turn,
yeah,
and it is not this year, I go and buy everything in tinfoil trays. I shouldn't be saying this on the radio. I'm going to chance that my mum isn't listening. Decant it into, you know, Pyrex at home.
Yes.
Put it on the oven. Pretend I cooked it. And here's my really hot tip. I cook chicken, not turkey, because it's way nicer.
It is much nicer, isn't it?
And I tell everyone it's micro turkey.
Okay. Well, very happy Christmas to you, micro turkey.
Scrooge.
Hope your mum is listening. Yep, someone get in touch with the Van Tulleken's mum right away and dob Chris in. No, don't do that. Chris Van Tulleken is Professor of Infection and Global Health at University College London, and it's the Royal Festival Hall if you want to book tickets for his Jurassic Fart show. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Nika on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner with Putin in Russia. Meanwhile, NATO foreign ministers will meet without the US. We'll discuss just how far we are from peace in Europe.
And it's Wednesday, so the Times' Giles Corran and the former Conservative minister Edwina Curry will be here to go through the news.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio. Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Celebrate Black Friday with Silver Sea. Enjoy savings of up to £8,000 per suite on expedition voyages and up to £5,000 per suite on classic voyages. Book your sailing between November 11th and December 2nd, 2025 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/Black Friday sale.
Across the UK,
on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Plenty of you have got thoughts about the Crown Estate and what it's all about. This one comes in from Nigel in Stamford. The opaque nature of royalty, their finances and unearned privilege. It's a medieval disgrace at taxpayers' expense. Neil says Clive Betts, yet another Labour MP who refuses to answer questions. Times Radio has had its fill of evasive time wasters today. Well, actually, I thought Clive Betts did it with a certain amount of dignity and also a little bit of a smile. I don't think it was quite as bad as what Jeremy Griffin had to put up with. And this one comes in from Jeff, who says there needs to be a much more sweeping inquiry into the Crown Estate. This secretive organisation controls vast areas of land and coast, delivering revenue straight to the royals with little or no scrutiny. Hence, as David Dimbleby said in The Times, Charles is the first billionaire to enter Buck House. Ronica, it has been fantastic to have you in the studio yesterday and today. Did you have holiday booked in June? Are you busy cancelling it now?
I never book holiday in June because it's the high, high, high ceremonial season of things like Trooping the Colour and Royal Ascot. So I was always going to be around, and now I'll be around even more.
So you would definitely be attending the Select Committee hearings, wouldn't you?
I'll be requesting a ticketed seat, whether or not Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor appears, because I think that is going to make fascinating watching and questioning.
And just put this into context for us. It is a big thing, isn't it, for Parliament to now be getting involved, because it is part of parliamentary procedure that you cannot be asking those kind of questions and naming names on the floor of the House.
What was really interesting to watch as an observer and a royal reporter in the run-up to the former Duke of York being deduked and then 2 weeks later being deprinced was it being battered backwards and forwards from Buckingham Palace to government, back to Buckingham Palace, and government saying, we will be guided by the King and the royal family on this. And then, you know, the King making the movements that he did and removing all the titles. And then you started to see and hear much more emboldened statements from members of Parliament, from Keir Starmer twice, once when we were in Brazil with Prince William, talking about how he, you know, responding to the fact that he thought Prince Andrew, the former prince, should possibly respond to the US Congress. And there is a feeling that Parliament has been emboldened by this. Now you have this move, and it is a big move by the Public Accounts Committee. So I think, yes, absolutely. You know, the age of deference has completely gone. The public will probably feel quite reassured by that and feel reassured that government is finally going to start asking some more probing questions. Perhaps it should have done a while ago.
I suspect that this may well be the topic of your podcast this week. When would that drop?
That will drop on Friday. And I suspect Kate and I will be talking a lot about this on our podcast, The Royals.
And how will Meghan be feeling about all of this? And I'm only mentioning her because she's got a launch, hasn't she?
She was, and she is launching her new Christmas special of As Ever Tomorrow. I suspect that might not be leaving the news now. Oh dear.
Right, okay. There was quite a lot in that sing-song, oh dear, there, Roya. Lovely to have your company. I hope you'll be back on the afternoon show soon. Rosie Wright will join me tomorrow. We've got a fantastic guest as well. I'll be talking to Aline van der Velden, who is the AI creator of Tilly Norwood. She is an artificial intelligence actress. There's been such a backlash against her existence, but Aline has got some very interesting things to say about the future of the creative community and AI. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was, and we hope always will be, Ryan Boyden. Up next, John Pienaar with Drive. Have a nice evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Roya. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A report into the Hillsborough disaster has found some police officers were guilty of complacency, failure and a concerted effort to blame fans. And the Commons Public Accounts Committee has announced an inquiry into the Crown Estate property leases. Coming up, I'll be talking live to Sir Brian Leveson, the senior former judge who penned the report, suggesting the government should limit the right to trial by jury. And we're going to be looking east, where President Trump's envoy and his son-in-law are currently in Moscow for a meeting with Vladimir Putin as efforts continue to end the Ukraine war.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The Commons Public Accounts Committee is to launch a wide-ranging inquiry into the Crown Estate property leases held by the royal family. It follows questions over the organisation's lease of the 30-room Royal Lodge to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. In October, The Times revealed the former prince had been paying a peppercorn rent for the Windsor mansion for two decades. He's now to live on the Sandringham estate at the King's private expense. Clive Betts is the Labour MP for Sheffield South East and a member of the committee. Speaking to Times Radio, he refused to be drawn on whether Mr. Mountbatten Windsor would appear at the inquiry.
There aren't, precedents. There aren't rules. The committee will look at the situation as it is. It will look at the situation with regard to the individual who's been renting the Royal Lodge. His status has clearly changed. Now, whether that therefore changes how the committee may deal with that is a matter the committee will deal with at the time.
Vladimir Putin says Europe's demands for a deal to end the war in Ukraine are not acceptable. In a speech in Moscow, the Russian president said, "We are not going to fight with Europe, but if Europe wants to fight with us, we are ready right now." Putin was scheduled to meet US envoy Steve Witkoff earlier this afternoon for negotiations on the draft peace plan, but the meeting appears to have been delayed. The former Ukrainian MP Hanna Hopko told Times Radio she's not expecting any positive developments from US-led negotiations.
Europe must lead, not always look at the White House and to see how Trump and his Witkoff and other guys who just want to make money, who just want to profit from this war. And it's not in the interest of European security.
The Justice Secretary, David Lammy's, announced juries will be scrapped in England and Wales for defendants facing a sentence of 3 years or less. Magistrates will also be handed more powers in a bid to reduce court backlogs. The former Director of Public Prosecution, Sir David Calvert-Smith, told Times Radio the reforms wouldn't be necessary if the court system was properly funded.
My worry is that every time we meet a problem like this, the cry goes up, well, let's get rid of juries, that'll make it all quicker. Of course it will, but it simply removes what seems to me as a citizen of this country to be one of its crowning glories, that ordinary people do take part in trial of serious criminal cases. If the money's not there and it's not going to be provided, then something else will have to be done. I quite understand that.
An inquiry has found sex offences against women aren't given the same response as other high-priority crimes. A report in the wake of the rape and murder of Sarah Everard by an off-duty police officer has heard from her mother, who says she's tormented thinking of her daughter's final hours. And a report into the 1989 Hillsborough disaster has found police were guilty of complacency, failure and a concerted effort to blame fans. 97 Liverpool supporters were killed in the stadium crush, considered the most catastrophic event in British sporting history. The police watchdog says 12 officers would have faced misconduct proceedings if they hadn't retired before investigations started. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Let's assume that you're a law-abiding citizen and you'll never be tried before a judge or jury. It is a big and presumptuous assumption, I know, because some of you may well have been and more of you may in future. I'm not here to judge. But if you're told you're losing the right to trial by jury, will you feel outraged, stripped of a time-hallowed but also fundamental human right as a citizen of a free country? Now, many may shrug and say, no, maybe you've never thought about it. Most of us have probably got other less remote and theoretical things to worry about, but it is a basic right, and it is a safeguard of our liberties. And the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is radically limiting the right to jury trial. Not, he says, because that right isn't important, because it is. He wants to take pressure off our straining and troubled justice system with its backlog of 80,000 Crown Court cases to save it from collapse. So, is this a right we can afford to lose? And if you don't care, should you not care? Tell me what you're thinking now about this. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. In a moment, I'll get you right up to date with the Justice Secretary's plans, and we're going to hear live from the senior judge who recommended limiting the right to jury trial, and who's now seeing the government, well, going a bit further than he suggested. Send me that tweet. Send me that text.
Let's look at it. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, speaking in the Commons earlier, detailed plans to reform jury trials across England and Wales.
These reforms are bold, Mr. Speaker, but they're necessary. I'm clear that jury trials will continue to be the cornerstone of the system for the most serious offences. Those likely to receive a sentence over 3 years and all indictable-only offences. Among others, this will include rape, murder, manslaughter, grievous bodily harm, robbery and arson with intent to kill.
Well, the Justice Secretary told Times Radio Breakfast earlier it'd take years to clear the backlog of delayed cases in the courts. And in the Commons, the Conservative Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, he responded.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This morning, more than 50 Crown courtrooms sit empty in England alone. In fact, over 21,000 court days have gone unused this year. Yeah. And why? Not because there are too many juries, but because the Justice Secretary won't fund the sitting days. Yeah. Yeah. Had he done so, the backlog would have shrunk by up to 10,000 cases rather than the fact it's risen this year. The truth is, scrapping juries is a choice.
The Conservative spokesman, Robert Jenrick. Now, let's get the thoughts of Oliver Wright, the policy editor at The Times. Hello, Oliver.
Hello.
Hi, Oliver. Could you just sum up the key changes here? And do tell us, does the Justice Secretary, is it clear that he backed away from more radical changes because of an angry reaction from some lawyers?
Yeah, I think he did certainly back away from what he was talking about in those leaked documents just a few weeks ago, where they were talking about restricting the right to a jury trial to those offences that would result in a prison sentence of 5 years or more. Now, what they've come up with in the end is an end to this system where effectively a defendant can decide which way they are tried, whether they're tried in the magistrate's court or whether they're just tried in front of a jury in the Crown Court. Offences known as sort of either way offences, and that's where it's being limited. And they're basically saying a defendant will not have the right to be tried by a jury in those cases. It will be carried out in the magistrate's court. Now, the argument on behalf of the government is that A, this will reduce the backlog in the courts, and perhaps more importantly from their point of view, they say it will mean that victims see justice more quickly. They say there is evidence that some defendants are deliberately choosing to request a jury trial in the Crown Courts because they know there are delays in the system and that they won't necessarily face justice for quite a while, and particularly if they're out on bail, then there is some advantage in that. So this